He was looking at me, amazed and disbelieving. "You expect me to believe that? The goddamn thing crunched. I heard it, so you can just shut up." He stared at me, his eyes wide. "What? What did you say to me?" I took a step closer to him. I could feel a vein throbbing in the middle of my forehead. I couldn't remember the last time I'd felt so angry. "Aren't you glad Mr. Jingles is okay? After all the talks we've had about how our job is to keep the prisoners calm, especially when it gets near the end for them, I thought you'd be glad, relieved, with Del having to take the walk tomorrow and all." Percy looked from me to Brutal, his studied calmness dissolving into uncertainty. "What the hell game do you boys think you're playing?" he asked. "None of this is a game, my friend," Brutal said. "You thinking it is? Well, that's just one of the reasons you can't be trusted. You want to know the absolute truth? I think you're a pretty sad case."
"You want to watch it?" Percy said.
Now there was a rawness in his voice, fear creeping back in after all, fear of what we might want with him, fear of what we might be up to. I was glad to hear it. It would make him easier to deal with.
"I know people. Important people."
"So you say, but you're such a dreamer," Brutal said. He sounded as if he was on the verge of laughter. Percy dropped the polishing rag onto the seat of the chair with the clamps attached to the arms and legs.
"I killed that mouse,"
he said in a voice that was not quite steady. "Go on and check for yourself," I said. "It's a free country."
"I will," he said. "I will."
He stalked past us, mouth set, small hands. Wharton was right. They were pretty, fiddling with his comb. He went up the steps and ducked through into my office. Brutal and I stood by old Sparky, waiting for him to come back and not talking. I don't know about Brutal, but I couldn't think of a thing to say. I didn't even know how to think about what we had just seen. 3 minutes passed. Brutal picked up Percy's rag and began to polish the thick back slats of the electric chair. He had time to finish one and start another before Percy came back. He stumbled and almost fell, coming down the steps from the office to the storage room floor, and when he crossed to us, he came at an uneven strut. His face was shocked and unbelieving.
"You switched him," he said in a shrill, accusatory voice. "You switched my somehow, you bastards! You're playing with me, and you're going to be goddamn sorry if you don't stop! I'll see you on the goddamn breadlines if you don't stop! Who do you think you are?"
He quit, panting for breath, his hands clenched. "I'll tell you who we are," I said. "We're the people you work with, Percy, but not for very much longer." I reached out and clamped my hands on his shoulders. Not real hard, but it was a clamp, all right. Yes, it was. Percy reached up to break it. "Take your—" Brutal grabbed his right hand. The whole thing, small and soft and white, disappeared into Brutal's tanned fist. "Shut up your cake hole, sonny. If you know what's good for you, you'll take this one last opportunity to dig the wax out of your ears." I turned him around, lifted him onto the platform, then backed him up until the backs of his knees struck the seat of the electric chair and he had to sit down. His calm was gone, the meanness and the arrogance, too. Those things were real enough, but you have to remember that Percy was very young. At his age, they were still only a thin veneer, like an ugly shade of enamel paint. You could still chip through. And I judged that Percy was now ready to listen. "I want your word," I said.
"My word about what?"
His mouth was still trying to sneer, but his eyes were terrified. The power in the switch room was locked off, but old Sparky's wooden seat had its own power, and right then I judged that Percy was feeling it.
"Your word that if we put you out front for it, tomorrow night you'll really go on to Briar Ridge and leave us alone,"
Brutal said, speaking with a vehemence I had never heard from him before,
"that you'll put in for a transfer the very next day." "And if I won't? If I should just call up certain people and tell them you're harassing me and threatening me, bullying me?"
"We might get the bum's rush if your connections are as good as you seem to think they are," I said. "But we'd make sure you left your fair share of blood on the floor, too, Percy."
"About that mouse? Huh! You think anyone's gonna care that I stepped on a condemned murderer's pet mouse? Outside of this loony bin, that is."
"No. But three men saw you just standing there with your thumb up your ass while Wild Bill Wharton was trying to strangle Dean Stanton with his wrist chains. About that, people will care, Percy, I promise you. About that, even your offsides uncle, the governor, is going to care. Percy's cheeks and brow flushed a patchy red.
"Ye think they'd believe you?"
he asked, but his voice had lost a lot of its angry force. Clearly, he thought someone might believe us, and Percy didn't like being in trouble. Breaking the rules was okay. Getting caught breaking them was not. "Well, I got some photos of Dean's neck before the bruising went down," Brutal said. I had no idea if this was true or not, but it certainly sounded good. "You know what those pics say? That Wharton got a pretty good shot at it before anyone pulled him off, although you were right there and on Wharton's blind side. You'd have some hard questions to answer, wouldn't you? And a thing like that could follow a man for quite a spell. Chances are it'd still be there long after his relatives were out of the state capitol and back home drinking mint juleps on the front porch. A man's work record can be a mighty interesting thing, and a lot of people get a chance to look at it over the course of a lifetime." Percy's eyes flicked back and forth mistrustfully between us. His left hand went to his hair and smoothed it. He said nothing, but I thought we almost had him. "Come on, let's quit this," I said. "You don't want to be here any more than we want you here, isn't that so?"
"I hate it here," he burst out. "I hate the way you treat me, the way you never gave me a chance."
That last was far from true, but I judged this wasn't the time to argue the matter.
"But I don't like to be pushed around, either. My daddy taught me that once you start down that road, you most likely end up letting people push around your whole life."
His eyes, not as pretty as his hands, but almost flashed.
"I especially don't like being pushed around by big apes like this guy."
He glanced at my old friend and grunted.
"Brutal, you got the right nickname at least."
"You have to understand something, Percy," I said. "The way we look at it, you've been pushing us around. We keep telling you the way we do things around here, and you keep doing things your own way, then hiding behind your political connections when things turn out wrong. Stepping on Delacroix's mouse," Brutal caught my eye, and I backtracked in a hurry. "Trying to step on Delacroix's mouse is just a case in point. You push and push and push. We're finally pushing back, that's all. But listen, if you do right, you'll come out of this looking good, like a young man on his way up, and smelling like a rose. Nobody'll ever know about this little talk we're having. So what do you say? Act like a grown-up. Promise you'll leave after Dell." He thought it over, and after a moment or two, a look came into his eyes, the sort of look a fella gets when he's just had a good idea. I didn't like it much, because any idea which seemed good to Percy wouldn't seem good to us.
"If nothing else," Brutal said, "just think how nice it'd be to get away from that sack of puss Wharton."
Percy nodded, and I let him get out of the chair. He straightened his uniform shirt, tucked it in at the back, gave his hair a pass-through with his comb. Then he looked at us.
"Okay, I agree. I'm out front for Dell tomorrow night. I'll put in for Briar Ridge the very next day. We call it quits right there. Good enough?"
"Good enough," I said. That look was still in his eyes, but right then I was too relieved to care. He stuck out his hand.
"Shake on it?"
I did. So did Brutal. More fools us. Chapter 4. The next day was the thickest yet, and the last of our strange October heat. Thunder was rumbling in the west when I came to work, and the dark clouds were beginning to stack up there. They moved closer as the night came down, and we could see blue-white forks of lightning jabbing out of them. There was a tornado in Trepingas County around 10 that night. It killed 4 people and tore the roof off the livery stable in Tefton, and vicious thunderstorms and gale-force winds at Cold Mountain. Later it seemed to me as if the very heavens had protested the bad death of Edouard Delacroix. Everything went just fine to begin with. Dell had spent a quiet day in his cell, sometimes playing with Mr. Jingles, but mostly just lying on his bunk and petting him. Wharton tried to get trouble started a couple of times. Once he hollered down to Dell about the mousy burgers they were going to have after old Lucky Pierre was dancing the two-step down in hell. But the little Cajun didn't respond, and Wharton, apparently deciding that was his best shot, gave it up. At 10:15, Brother Schuster showed up and delighted us all by saying he would recite the Lord's Prayer with Dell in Cajun French. It seemed like a good omen. In that we were all wrong, of course. The witnesses began to arrive around 11, mostly talking in low tones about the impending weather and speculating about the possibility of a power outage postponing the electrocution. None of them seemed to know that old Sparky ran off a generator, and unless that took a direct lightning hit, the show would go on. Harry was in the switch room that night, so he and Bill Dodge and Percy Wetmore acted as ushers, seeing folks into their seats and asking each one if he'd like a cold drink of water. There were two women present, the sister of the girl Dell had raped and murdered, and the mother of one of the fire victims. The latter lady was large and pale and determined. She told Harry Terwilliger that she hoped the man she'd come to see was good and scared, that he knew the fires in the furnace were stoked for him, and that Satan's imps were waiting for him. Then she burst into tears and buried her face in a lace hanky that was almost the size of a pillow slip. Thunder, hardly muffled at all by the tin roof, banged harsh and loud. People glanced up uneasily. Men who looked uncomfortable wearing ties this late at night wiped at their florid cheeks. It was hotter than blue blazes in the storage shed. And, of course, they kept turning their eyes to old Sparky. They might have made jokes about this chore earlier in the week, but the jokes were gone by 11:30 or so that night. I started all this by telling you that the humor went out of the situation in a hurry for the people who had to sit down in that oak chair. But the condemned prisoners weren't the only ones who lost the smiles off their faces when the time actually came. It just seemed so bald, somehow, squatting up there on its platform, with the clamps on the legs sticking off to either side, looking like the things a person with polio would have to wear. There wasn't much talk, and when the thunder boomed again, as sharp and personal as a splintering tree, the sister of Delacroix's victim gave a little scream. The last person to take his seat in the witnesses' section was Curtis Anderson, Warden Moores's stand-in. At 11:30, I approached Delacroix's cell, with Brutal and Dean walking slightly behind me. Dell was sitting on his bunk, with Mr. Jingles in his lap. The mouse's head was stretched forward toward the condemned man, his little oil-spot eyes rapt on Dell's face. Dell was stroking the top of Mr. Jingles's head between his ears. Large, silent tears were rolling down Dell's face, and it was these the mouse seemed to be peering at. Dell looked up at the sound of our footsteps. He was very pale. From behind me I sensed, rather than saw, John Coffey standing at his cell door, watching. Dell winced at the sound of my keys clashing against metal, but held steady, continuing to stroke Mr. Jingles's head as I turned the locks and ran the door open.
"Hi there, Boss Edgecombe," he said. "Hi there, boys. Say hi, Mr. Jingles."
But Mr. Jingles only continued to look raptly up at the balding little man's face, as if wondering at the source of his tears. The colored spool had been neatly laid aside in the corona box, laid aside for the last time, I thought, and felt a pang. Edouard Delacroix, as an officer of the court,
Boss Edgecombe?
I thought about just running on with the set speech, then thought again. "What is it, Dell?" He held the mouse out to me.
"Here. Don't let nothing happen to Mr. Jingles."
"Dell, I don't think he'll come to me. He's not..."
"May we? He say he will. He say he know all about you, Boss Edgecombe, and you gonna take him down to that place in Florida where the mousies do their tricks. He say he trust you."
He held his hand out farther, and I'll be damned if the mouse didn't step off his palm and onto my shoulder. It was so light I couldn't even feel it through my uniform coat, but I sensed it. like a small heat.
And, boss, don't let that baden near him again. Don't let that baden hurt my mouse.
No, Dell, I won't. The question was, what was I supposed to do with him right then? I couldn't very well march Delacroix past the witnesses with a mouse perched on my shoulder.
I'll take him, boss, the voice rumbled from behind me.
It was John Coffey's voice, and it was eerie the way it came right then, as though he had read my mind.
Just for now, if Dell don't mind.
Dell nodded, relieved.
Yeah, you take him, John, till this foolishment done. Bien. And then after...
His gaze shifted back to Brutal and me.
You gonna take him down to Florida, to that Mouseville place?
Yeah, most likely Paul and I will do it together, Brutal said,
watching with a troubled and unquiet eye as Mr. Jingle stepped off my shoulder and into Coffee's huge outstretched palm. Mr. Jingles did this with no protest or attempt to run. Indeed, he scampered as readily up John Coffey's arm as he had stepped onto my shoulder.
"We'll take some of our vacation time, won't we, Paul?"
I nodded. Dell nodded, too, eyes bright, just a trace of a smile on his lips.
"People pay a dime apiece to see him. 2 cents for the kiddies. Ain't that right, Boss Howell?"
"That's right, Dell."
"You a good man, Boss Howell," Dell said. "You too, Boss Edgecombe. You yell at me sometimes, but not less you have to. You all good men, except for that Percy. I wish I could have met you someplace else. Mauvais temps, mauvais chance."
"I got something to say to you, Dell," I told him. "They're just the words I have to say to everyone before we walk. No big deal, but it's part of my job, okay?"
"Oui, monsieur,"
he said, and looked at Mr. Jingles, perched on John Coffey's broad shoulder for the last time.
"Au revoir, mon ami,"
he said, beginning to cry harder.
"Je t'aime, mon petit."
He blew the mouse a kiss. It should have been funny, that blown kiss, or maybe just grotesque. But it wasn't. I met Dean's eye for a moment, then had to look away. Dean stared down the corridor toward the restraint room and smiled strangely. I believe he was on the verge of tears. As for me, I said what I had to say, beginning with the part about how I was an officer of the court, and when I was done, Delacroix stepped out of his cell for the last time. "Hold on a second longer, Hoss," Brutal said, and checked the shaved spot on the crown of Dell's head where the cap would go. He nodded at me, then clapped Dell on the shoulder. "Right with Eversharp. We're on our way." So Edouard Delacroix took his last walk on the Green Mile with little streams of mingled sweat and tears running down his cheeks and big thunder rolling in the sky overhead. Brutal walked on the condemned man's left, I was on his right, Dean was to the rear. Schuster was in my office, with guards Ringgold and Battle standing in the corners and keeping watch. Schuster looked up at Dell, smiled, and then addressed him in French. It sounded stilted to me, but it worked wonders. Dell smiled back, then went to Schuster, put his arms around him, hugged him. Ringgold and Battle tensed, but I raised my hands to them and shook my head. Schuster listened to Dell's flood of tear-choked French, nodded as if he understood perfectly, and patted him on the back. He looked at me over the little man's shoulder and said, "I hardly understand a quarter of what he's saying."
"Don't think it matters," Brutal rumbled.
"Neither do I, son," Schuster said with a grin. He was the best of them, and now I realize I have no idea what became of him. I hope he kept his faith, whatever else befell. He urged Delacroix onto his knees, then folded his hands. Delacroix did the same.
"Notre père, qui êtes aux cieux?"
Schuster began, and Delacroix joined him. They spoke the Lord's Prayer together in that liquid-sounding Cajun French, all the way to, "Mais délivrez-nous du mal, ainsi soit-il." By then, Dell's tears had mostly stopped, and he looked calm. Some Bible verses in English followed, not neglecting the old standby about the still waters. When that was done, Schuster started to get up, but Dell held onto the sleeve of his shirt and said something in French. Schuster listened carefully, frowning. He responded. Dell said something else, then just looked at him hopefully. Schuster turned to me and said, "He's got something else, Mr. Edgecombe, a prayer I can't help him with because of my faith. Is it all right?" I looked at the clock on the wall and saw it was 17 minutes to midnight. "Yes," I said, "but it'll have to be quick. We've got a schedule to keep here, you know." "Yes, I do." He turned to Delacroix and gave him a nod. Dell closed his eyes as if to pray, but for a moment said nothing. A frown creased his forehead, and I had a sense of him reaching far back in his mind, as a man may search a small attic room for an object which hasn't been used or needed for a long, long time. I glanced at the clock again and almost said something, would have if Brutal hadn't twitched my sleeve and shaken his head. Then Dell began, speaking softly but quickly in that Cajun, which was as round and soft and sensual as a young woman's breast.
"Marie, je vous salue, Marie, oui, pleine de grâce. Le Seigneur est avec vous. Vous êtes bénie entre toutes les femmes, et mon cher Jésus, le fruit de vos entrailles, est béni."
He was crying again, but I don't think he knew it.
"Sainte Marie, oh, ma mère, mère de Dieu, priez pour moi, priez pour nous, pauvres pécheurs. Maintenant est l'heure de notre mort, l'heure de mon mort."
He took a deep, shuddering breath.
"Ainsi soit-il."
Lightning spilled through the room's one window in a brief blue-white glare as Delacroix got to his feet. Everyone jumped and cringed except for Del himself. He still seemed lost in the old prayer. He reached out with one hand, not looking to see where it went. Brutal took it and squeezed it briefly. Delacroix looked at him and smiled a little.
"Nous voyons,"
he began, then stopped. With a conscious effort, he switched back to English.
"We can go now, Boss Howell, Boss Edgecombe. I'm right with God."
"That's good," I said, wondering how right with God Dell was going to feel 20 minutes from now when he stood on the other side of the electricity. I hoped his last prayer had been heard, and that Mother Mary was praying for him with all her heart and soul, because Edouard Delacroix, rapist and murderer, right then needed all the praying he could get his hands on. Outside, thunder bashed across the sky again. "Come on, Dell. Not far now."
"Fine, boss. That fine, because I ain't scared no more."
So he said, but I saw in his eyes that, Our Father or no Our Father, Hail Mary or no Hail Mary, he lied. By the time they crossed the rest of the green carpet and ducked through the little door, almost all of them are scared. "Stop at the bottom, Dell," I told him in a low voice as he went through, but it was advice I needn't have given him. He stopped at the foot of the stairs, all right, stopped cold, and what did it was the sight of Percy Wetmore standing there on the platform, with the sponge bucket by one foot and the phone that went to the governor just visible beyond his right hip.
"No,"
Dell said in a low, horrified voice.
"No, no, not him."
"Walk on," Brutal said. "You just keep your eyes on me and Paul. Forget he's there at all." But people had turned to look at us, but by moving my body a bit, I could still grip Delacroix's left elbow without being seen. "Steady," I said, in a voice only Dell and perhaps Brutal could hear. "The only thing most of these people will remember about you is how you go out, so give them something good." The loudest crack of thunder yet broke overhead at that moment, loud enough to make the storage room's tin roof vibrate. Percy jumped as if someone had goosed him, and Dell gave a small, contemptuous snort of laughter.
"He'd get much louder than that. He's gonna peedle in his pants again," he said,
and then squared his shoulders, not that he had much to square.
"Come on, let's get it over."
We walked to the platform. Delacroix ran a nervous eye over the witnesses, about 25 of them this time, as we went, but Brutal, Dean, and I kept our own eyes trained on the chair. All looked in order to me. I raised one thumb and a questioning eyebrow to Percy, who gave me a little one-sided grimace, as if to say, "What do you mean, is everything all right? Of course it is." I hoped he was right. Brutal and I reached automatically for Delacroix's elbows as he stepped up onto the platform. It's only 8 or so inches up from the floor, but you'd be surprised how many of them, even the toughest of tough babies, need help to make that last step up of their lives. Del did okay, though. He stood in front of the chair for a moment, resolutely not looking at Percy, and actually spoke to it, as if introducing himself.
"C'est moi,"
he said. Percy reached for him, but Delacroix turned around on his own and sat down. I knelt on what was now his left side, and Brutal knelt on his right. I guarded my crotch and my throat in the manner I have already described, then swung the clamp in so that its open jaws encircled the skinny white flesh just above the Cajun's ankle. Thunder bellowed, and I jumped. Sweat ran in my eye, stinging. "Mouseville," I kept thinking for some reason. "Mouseville, and how it cost a dime to get in. 2 cents for the kiddies, who would look at Mr. Jingles through his ivy glass windows." The clamp was balky, wouldn't shut. I could hear Dell breathing in great, dry pulls of air, lungs that would be charred bags less than 4 minutes from now, laboring to keep up with his fear-driven heart. The fact that he had killed 6 people seemed at that moment the least important thing about him. I'm not trying to say anything about right and wrong here, but only to tell how it was. Dean knelt next to me and whispered, "What's wrong, Paul?" "I can't," I began, and then the clamp closed with an audible snapping sound. It must have also pinched a fold of Delacroix's skin in its jaws, because he flinched and made a little hissing noise. "Sorry," I said.
"It's okay, boss," Del said. "He'd only gone hurt for a minute."
Brutal's side had the clamp with the electrode in it, which always took a little longer. And so we stood up, all three of us, at almost exactly the same time. Dean reached for the wrist clamp on Del's left, and Percy went to the one on his right. I was ready to move forward if Percy should need help, but he did better with his wrist clamp than I'd done with my ankle clamp. I could see Del trembling all over now, as if a low current were already passing through him. I could smell his sweat, too. It was sour and strong and reminded me of weak pickle juice. Dean nodded to Percy. Percy turned back over his shoulder, I could see a place just under the angle of his jaw where he'd cut himself shaving that day, and said in a low, firm voice, "Roll on one." There was a hum, sort of like the sound an old refrigerator makes when it kicks on, and the hanging lights in the storage room brightened. There were a few low gasps and murmurs from the audience. Del jerked in his chair, his hands gripping the ends of the oak arms hard enough to turn the knuckles white. His eyes rolled rapidly from side to side in their sockets, and his dry breathing quickened even more. He was almost panting now.
"Steady," Brutal murmured. "Steady, Del. You're doing just fine. Hang on, you're doing just fine." "Hey, you guys," I thought. "Come and see what Mr. Jingles can do."
And overhead the thunder banged again. Percy stepped grandly around to the front of the electric chair. This was his big moment. He was at center stage. All eyes were on him. All that was but for one set. Delacroix saw who it was and looked down at his lap instead. I would have bet you $1 to a donut that Percy would flub his lines when he actually had to say them for an audience. But he reeled them off without a hitch, in an eerily calm voice.
"Edouard Delacroix, you have been condemned to die in the electric chair. Sentence passed by a jury of your peers and imposed by a judge of good standing in this state. God save the people of this state. Do you have anything to say before sentence is carried out?"
Del tried to speak, and at first nothing came out but a terrified whisper full of air and vowel sounds. The shadow of a contemptuous smile touched the corners of Percy's lips, and I could have cheerfully shot him right there. Vandel licked his lips and tried again.
"I'm sorry for what I do," he said. "I give anything to turn back the clock, but no one can."
So now thunder exploded like an airburst mortar shell above us. Dell jumped as much as the clamps would allow, eyes starting wildly out of his wet face.
"So now I paid the price. God forgive me."
He licked his lips again and looked at Brutal.
"Don't forget your promise about Mr. Jingles," he said in a lower voice that was meant just for us.
"We won't. Don't worry," I said and patted Delacroix's clay-cold hand.
"He's going to Mouseville."
"The hell he is," Percy said, speaking from the corner of his mouth like a yard-wise con as he hooked the restraining belt across Delacroix's chest.
"There's no such place. It's a fairy tale these guys made up to keep you quiet. Just thought you should know, faggot."
A stricken light in Del's eyes told me that part of him had known, but would have kept the knowledge from the rest of him if allowed. I looked at Percy, dumbfounded and furious, and he looked back at me levelly as if to ask what I meant to do about it. And he had me, of course. There was nothing I could do about it. Not in front of the witnesses, not with Delacroix now sitting on the furthest edge of life. There was nothing to do now but go on with it. Finish it. Percy took the mask from its hook and rolled it down over Dell's face, snugging it tight under the little man's undershot chin so as to stretch the hole in the top. Taking the sponge from the bucket and putting it in the cap was next, and it was here that Percy diverged from the routine for the first time. Instead of just bending over and fishing the sponge out, he took the steel cap from the back of the chair and bent over with it in his hands. Instead of bringing the sponge to the cap, in other words, which would have been the natural way to do it, he brought the cap to the sponge. I should have realized something was wrong, but I was too upset. It was the only execution I ever took part in where I felt totally out of control. As for Brutal, he never looked at Percy at all, not as Percy bent over the bucket, moving so as to partly block what he was doing from our view, not as he straightened up and turned to Dell with the cap in his hands and the brown circle of sponge already inside it. Brutal was looking at the cloth which had replaced Dell's face, watching the way the black silk mask drew in, outlining the circle of Dell's open mouth, and then puffed out again with his breath. There were big beads of perspiration on Brutal's forehead and at his temples just below the hairline. I had never seen him sweat at an execution before. Behind him, Dean looked distracted and ill as if he was fighting not to lose his supper. We all understood that something was wrong. I know that now. We just couldn't tell what it was. No one knew, not then, about the questions Percy had been asking Jack Van Hay. There were a lot of them, but I suspect most were just camouflage. What Percy wanted to know about, the only thing Percy wanted to know about, I believe, was the sponge. The purpose of the sponge, why it was soaked in brine, and what would happen if it was not soaked in brine. What would happen if the sponge was dry? Percy jammed the cap down on Dell's head. The little man jumped and moaned again, this time louder. Some of the witnesses stirred uneasily on their folding chairs. Dean took a half-step forward, meaning to help with the chin-strap, and Percy motioned him curtly to step back. Dean did, hunching a little and wincing as another blast of thunder shook the storage shed. This time it was followed by the first spatters of rain across the roof. They sounded hard, like someone flinging handfuls of goobers onto a washboard. "You've heard people say, 'My blood ran cold,' about things, haven't you?" "Sure. All of us have.
But the only time in all my years that I actually felt it happen to me was on that new and thunderstruck morning in October of 1932, at about 10 seconds past midnight. It wasn't the look of poisoned triumph on Percy Wetmore's face as he stepped away from the capped, clamped, and hooded figure sitting there in Old Sparky. It was what I should have seen and didn't. There was no water running down Dell's cheeks from out of the cap. That was when I finally got it.
"Edouard Delacroix," Percy was saying, "electricity shall not be passed through your body until you are dead, according to state law."
I looked over at Brutal in an agony that made my urinary infection seem like a bumped finger. "The sponge is dry," I mouthed at him, but he only shook his head, not understanding, and looked back at the mask over the Frenchman's face, where the man's last few breaths were pulling the black silk in and then blousing it out again. I reached for Percy's elbow, and he stepped away from me, giving me a flat look as he did so. It was only a momentary glance, but it told me everything. Later he would tell his lies and his half-truths, and most would be believed by the people who mattered, but I knew a different story. Percy was a good student when he was doing something he cared about. We found that out at the rehearsals, and he had listened carefully when Jack Van Hay explained how the brine-soaked sponge conducted the juice, channeling it, turning the charge into a kind of electric bullet to the brain. Oh, yes, Percy knew exactly what he was doing. I think I believed him later when he said he didn't know how far it would go. But that doesn't even count in the good intentions column, does it? I don't think so. Yet short of screaming in front of the assistant warden and all the witnesses for Jack Van Hay not to pull the switch, there was nothing I could do. Given another 5 seconds, I think I might have screamed just that, but Percy didn't give me another 5 seconds. "May God have mercy on your soul," he told the panting, terrified figure in the electric chair, then looked past him at the mesh-covered rectangle where Harry and Jack were standing, Jack with his hand on the switch marked Mabel's hair dryer. The doctor was standing to the right of that window, eyes fixed on the black bag between his feet, as silent and self-effacing as ever. "Roll on two." At first it was the same as always. The humming that was a little louder than the original cycle-up, but not much, and the mindless forward surge of Dell's body as his muscles spasmed. Then things started going wrong. The humming lost its steadiness and began to waver. It was joined by a crackling sound, like cellophane being crinkled. I could smell something horrible that I didn't identify as a mixture of burning hair and organic sponge until I saw blue tendrils of smoke curling out from beneath the edges of the cap. More smoke was streaming out of the hole in the top of the cap that the wire came in through. It looked like smoke coming out of the hole in an Indian's teepee. Delacroix began to jitter and twist in the chair, his mask-covered face snapping from side to side as if in some vehement refusal. His legs began to piston up and down in short strokes that were hampered by the clamps on his ankles. Thunder banged overhead, and now the rain began to pour down harder. I looked at Dean Stanton. He stared wildly back. There was a muffled pop from under the cap, like a pine knot exploding in a hot fire, and now I could see smoke coming through the mask as well, seeping out in little curls. I lunged toward the mesh between us and the switch room, but before I could open my mouth, Brutus Howell seized my elbow. His grip was hard enough to make the nerves in there tingle. He was as white as tallow, but not in a panic, not even close to being in a panic. "Don't you tell Jack to stop," he said in a low voice. "Whatever you do, don't tell him that. It's too late to stop." At first, when Dell began to scream, the witnesses didn't hear him. The rain on the tin roof had swelled to a roar, and the thunder was damn near continuous. But those of us on the platform heard him all right. Choked howls of pain from beneath the smoking mask, sounds an animal caught and mangled in a hay baler might make. The hum from the cap was ragged and wild now, broken by bursts of what sounded like radio static. Delacroix began to slam back and forth in the chair like a kid doing a tantrum. The platform shook, and he hit the leather restraining belt almost hard enough to pop it.
The current was also twisting him from side to side, and I heard the crunching snap as his right shoulder either broke or dislocated. It went with a sound like someone hitting a wooden crate with a sledgehammer. The crotch of his pants, no more than a blur because of the short pistoning strokes of his legs, darkened. Then he began to squeal, horrible sounds, high-pitched and rat-like, that were audible even over the rushing downpour. "What the hell's happening to him?" someone cried. "Are those clamps going to hold? Christ, the smell! Phew!" Then one of the two women, "Is this normal?" Delacroix snapped forward, dropped back, snapped forward, fell back. Percy was staring at him with slack-jawed horror. He had expected something, sure, but not this. The mask burst into flame on Delacroix's face. The smell of cooking hair and sponge was now joined by the smell of cooking flesh. Brutal grabbed the bucket the sponge had been in, it was empty now, of course, and charged for the extra-deep janitor sink in the corner. "Shouldn't I kill the juice, Paul?" Van Hay called through the mesh. He sounded completely rattled. "Shouldn't I—" "No!" I shouted back. Brutal had understood it first, but I hadn't been far behind. We had to finish it. Whatever else we might do in all the rest of our lives was secondary to that one thing. We had to finish with Delacroix. "Roll, for Christ's sake! Roll, roll, roll!" I turned to Brutal, hardly aware of the people talking behind us now, some on their feet, a couple screaming. "Quit that!" I yelled at Brutal. "No water! No water! Are you nuts?" Brutal turned toward me, a kind of dazed understanding on his face. Throw water on a man who was getting the juice. Oh, yes, that would be very smart. He looked around, saw the chemical fire extinguisher hanging on the wall, and got that instead. Good boy. The mask had peeled away from Delacroix's face enough to reveal features that had gone blacker than John Coffey's. His eyes, now nothing but misshapen globs of white, filmy jelly, had been blown out of their sockets and lay on his cheeks. His eyelashes were gone, and as I looked, the lids themselves caught fire and began to burn. Smoke puffed from the open V of his shirt, and then that too caught fire. And still the humming of the electricity went on and on, filling my head, vibrating in there. I think it's the sound mad people must hear, that or something like it. Dean started forward, thinking in some dazed way that he could beat the fire out of Del's shirt with his hands, and I yanked him away almost hard enough to pull him off his feet. Touching Delacroix at that point would have been like Brer Rabbit punching into the tar baby, an electrified tar baby in this case. I still didn't turn around to see what was going on behind us, but it sounded like pandemonium. Chairs falling over, people bellowing, a woman crying, "Stop it! Stop it! Oh, can't you see he's had enough?" at the top of her lungs. Curtis Anderson grabbed my shoulder and asked what was happening. For Christ's sake, what was happening, and why didn't I order Jack to shut down? "Because I can't," I said. "We've gone too far to turn back, can't you see that? It'll be over in a few more seconds anyway." But it was at least 2 minutes before it was over. The longest 2 minutes of my whole life. And through most of it, I think Delacroix was conscious. He screamed and jittered and rocked from side to side. Smoke poured from his nostrils and from a mouth that had gone the purple black of ripe plums. Smoke drifted up from his tongue the way smoke rises from a hot griddle. All the buttons on his shirt either burst or melted. His undershirt did not quite catch fire, but it charred, and smoke poured through it, and we could smell his chest hair roasting. Behind us, people were heading for the door like cattle in a stampede. They couldn't get out through it, of course. We were in a damn prison, after all, so they simply clustered around it while Delacroix fried. "Now I'm frying," old Toot had said when we were rehearsing for Arlen Bitterbuck. "I'm a dun-tom turkey." And the thunder rolled, and the rain ran down out of the sky in a perfect fury. At some point I thought of the doc and looked around for him. He was still there, but crumpled on the floor beside his black bag. He'd fainted. Brutal came up and stood beside me, holding the fire extinguisher. "Not yet," I said. "I know." We looked around for Percy, and saw him standing almost behind Sparky now, frozen, eyes huge, one knuckle crammed into his mouth. Then At last, Delacroix slumped back in the chair, his bulging, misshapen face lying over on one shoulder. He was still jittering, but we'd seen this before. It was the current running through him. The cap had come askew on his head, but when we took it off a little later, most of his scalp and his remaining fringe of hair came with it, bonded to the metal as if by some powerful adhesive. "Kill it," I called to Jack when 30 seconds had gone by, with nothing but electric jitters coming from the smoking, man-shaped lump of charcoal lolling in the electric chair. The hum died immediately, and I nodded to Brutal. He turned and slammed the fire extinguisher into Percy's arm so hard that Percy staggered backward and almost fell off the platform. "You do it," Brutal said. "You're running the show, after all, ain't you?" Percy gave him a look that was both sick and murderous, then armed the extinguisher, pumped it, cocked it, and shot a huge cloud of white foam over the man in the chair. I saw Dell's foot twitch once as the spray hit his face and thought, oh no, he might have to go again, but there was only that single twitch. Anderson had turned around and was bawling at the panicky witnesses, telling them everything was all right, everything was under control, just a power surge from the electrical storm, nothing to worry about. Next thing, he'd be telling them that what they smelled, a devil's mixture of burned hair, fried meat, and fresh-baked shit right out of Edouard Delacroix's crispy asshole, was Chanel No. 5. "Get Doc's stethoscope," I told Dean as the extinguisher ran dry. Delacroix was coated with white now, and the worst of the stench was being overlaid by a thin and bitter chemical smell. "Doc, should I..." "Never mind, Doc. Just get his stethoscope," I said. "Let's get this over. Get him out of here." Dean nodded. Over and out of here were two concepts that appealed to him just then. They appealed to both of us. He went over to Doc's bag and began rummaging in it. Doc was beginning to move again, so at least he hadn't had a stroke or a heart storm. That was good. But the way Brutal was looking at Percy wasn't. "Get down in the tunnel and wait by the gurney," I said. Percy swallowed.
"Paul, listen, I didn't know..."
"Shut up. Get down in the tunnel and wait by the gurney, now." He swallowed, grimaced as if it hurt, and then walked toward the door which led to the stairs and the tunnel. He carried the empty fire extinguisher in his arms as if it were a baby. Dean passed him, coming back to me with the stethoscope. I snatched it and set the earpieces. I'd done this before in the army, and it's sort of like riding a bike. You don't forget. I wiped at the foam on Delacroix's chest, then had to gag back vomit as a large, hot section of his skin simply slid away from the flesh beneath, the way the skin will slide off a, well, you know, a dun-tom turkey. "Oh, my God," a voice I didn't recognize almost sobbed behind me.
"Is it always this way? Why didn't somebody tell me? I never would have come."
"Too late now, friend," I thought. "Get that man out of here," I said to Dean, or Brutal, or whoever might be listening. I said it when I was sure I could speak without puking into Delacroix's smoking lap. "Get them all back by the door." I steeled myself as best I could, then put the disc of the stethoscope on the red-black patch of raw flesh I'd made on Del's chest. I listened, praying I would hear nothing, and that's just what I did hear. "He's dead," I told Brutal. "Thank Christ." "Yes, thank Christ. You and Dean get the stretcher. Let's unbuckle him and get him out of here fast." Chapter 5. We got his body down the 12 stairs and onto the gurney all right. My nightmare was that his cooked flesh might slough right off his bones as we lugged him. It was old Toots' dun-tom turkey that had gotten into my head. But, of course, that didn't happen. Curtis Anderson was upstairs soothing the spectators, trying to, anyway, and that was good for Brutal, because Anderson wasn't there to see when Brutal took a step toward the head of the gurney and pulled his arm back to slug Percy, who was standing there looking stunned. I caught his arm, and that was good for both of them. It was good for Percy because Brutal meant to deliver a blow of near decapitatory force, and good for Brutal because he would have lost his job if the blow had connected, and maybe ended up in prison himself. No, I said.
What do you mean, no?
He asked me furiously. How can you say no? You saw what he did. What are you telling me, that you're still going to let his connections protect him after what he did?
Yes.
Brutal stared at me, mouth agape, eyes so angry they were watering. Listen to me, Brutus. You take a poke at him, and most likely we all go. You, me, Dean, Harry, maybe even Jack Van Hay. Everyone else moves a rung or two up the ladder, starting with Bill Dodge, and the prison commission hires three or four breadline Barneys to fill the spots at the bottom. Maybe you can live with that, but... I cocked my thumb at Dean, who was staring down the dripping, brick-lined tunnel. He was holding his specs in one hand and looked almost as dazed as Percy. But what about Dean? He's got two kids, one in high school and one just about to go.
So what's it come down to? Brutal asked. We let him get away with it?
I didn't know the sponge was supposed to be wet,
Percy said in a faint, mechanical voice. This was the story he had rehearsed beforehand, of course, when he was expecting a painful prank instead of the cataclysm we had just witnessed.
It was never wet when we rehearsed.
Ah, you sucker, Brutal began and started for Percy. I grabbed him again and yanked him back. Footsteps clacked on the steps. I looked up, desperately afraid of seeing Curtis Anderson, but it was Harry Terwilliger. His cheeks were paper white, and his lips were purplish, as if he'd been eating blackberry cobbler. I switched my attention back to Brutal. For God's sake, Brutal, Delacroix's dead. Nothing can change that, and Percy's not worth it. Was the plan, or the beginnings of it, in my head even then? I've wondered about that since, let me tell you. I've wondered over the course of a lot of years, and have never been able to come up with a satisfactory answer. I suppose it doesn't matter much. A lot of things don't matter, but it doesn't keep a man from wondering about them, I've noticed.
You guys talk about me like I was a chump,
Percy said. He still sounded dazed and winded, as if someone had punched him deep in the gut, but he was coming back a little. You are a chump, Percy, I said.
Hey, you can't...
I controlled my own urge to hit him, only with the greatest effort. Water dripped hollowly from the bricks down in the tunnel. Our shadows danced huge and misshapen on the walls, like shadows in that Poe story about the big ape in the Rue Morgue. Thunder bashed, but down here it was muffled. I only want to hear one thing from you, Percy, and that's you repeating your promise to put in for Briar Ridge tomorrow.
Don't worry about that, he said sullenly.
He looked at the sheeted figure on the gurney, looked away, flicked his eyes up toward my face for a moment, then looked away again.
That would be for the best, Harry said. Otherwise you might get to know Wild Bill Wharton a whole lot better than you want to.
A slight pause.
We could see to it.
Percy was afraid of us. And he was probably afraid of what we might do if he was still around when we found out he'd been talking to Jack Van Hay about what the sponge was for and why we always soaked it in brine, but Harry's mention of Wharton woke real terror in his eyes. I could see him remembering how Wharton had held him, ruffling his hair and crooning to him.
"You wouldn't dare," Percy whispered.
"Yes, I would," Harry replied calmly. "And do you know what? I'd get away with it. Because you've already shown yourself to be careless as hell around the prisoners. Incompetent, too."
Percy's fists bunched and his cheeks colored in a thin pink.
"I am not
sure you are," Dean said, joining us. We formed a rough semicircle around Percy at the foot of the stairs, and even a retreat up the tunnel was blocked. The gurney was behind him, with its load of smoking flesh hidden under an old sheet.
"You just burned Delacroix alive! If that ain't incompetent, what is?"
Percy's eyes flickered. He had been planning to cover himself by pleading ignorance, and now he saw he was hoist by his own petard. I don't know what he might have said next, because Curtis Anderson came lunging down the stairs just then. We heard him and drew back from Percy a little so as not to look quite so threatening.
"What in the blue fuck was that all about?"
Anderson roared.
"Jesus Christ! There's puke all over the floor up there! And the smell! I got Magnuson and old Tutu to open both doors, but that smell won't come out for 5 damn years, that's what I'm betting. And that asshole Wharton is singing about it! I can hear him!"
"Can he carry a tune, Kurt?"
Brutal asked. You know how you can burn off illuminating gas with a single spark and not be hurt if you do it before the concentration gets too heavy? This was like that. We took an instant to gape at Brutus, and then we were all howling. Our high, hysterical laughter flapped up and down the gloomy tunnel like bats. Our shadows bobbed and flickered on the walls. Near the end, even Percy joined in. At last it died, and in its aftermath, we all felt a little better. Felt sane again. "Okay, boys," Anderson said, mopping at his teary eyes with his handkerchief and still snorting out an occasional hiccup of laughter. "What the hell happened?" "An execution," Brutal said. I think his even tone surprised Anderson, but it didn't surprise me, at least not much. Brutal had always been good at turning down his dials in a hurry. "A successful one."
"How in the name of Christ can you call a direct current abortion like that a success? We've got witnesses that won't sleep for a month. Hell, that fat old broad probably won't sleep for a year."
Brutal pointed at the gurney and the shape under the sheet. "He's dead, ain't he? As for your witnesses, most of them will be telling their friends tomorrow night that it was poetic justice. Dell there burned a bunch of people alive, so we turn around and burn him alive. Except they won't say it was us. They'll say it was the will of God working through us. Maybe there's even some truth to that. And you want to know the best part? The absolute cat's pajamas? Most of their friends will wish they'd been here to see it." He gave Percy a look both distasteful and sardonic as he said this last.
"And if their feathers are a little ruffled, so what?" Harry asked. "They volunteered for the damn job. Nobody drafted them."
"I didn't know the sponge was supposed to be wet," Percy said in his robot's voice. "It's never wet in rehearsal."
Dean looked at him with utter disgust.
"How many years did you spend pissing on the toilet seat before someone told you to put it up before you start?"
he snarled. Percy opened his mouth to reply, but I told him to shut up. For a wonder, he did. I turned to Anderson. "Percy fucked up, Curtis. That's what happened, pure and simple." I turned toward Percy, daring him to contradict me. He didn't, maybe because he read my eyes. Better that Anderson hear stupid mistake than on purpose. And besides, whatever was said down here in the tunnel didn't matter. What mattered, what always matters to the Percy Wetmores of the world, is what gets written down or overheard by the big bugs, the people who matter. Anderson looked at the five of us uncertainly. He even looked at Dell, but Dell wasn't talking.
"I guess it could be worse," Anderson said.
"That's right," I agreed. "He could still be alive." Curtis blinked. That possibility seemed not to have crossed his mind. "I want a complete report about this on my desk tomorrow," he said. "And none of you are going to talk to Warden Moores about it until I've had my chance, are you?" We shook our heads vehemently. If Curtis Anderson wanted to tell the warden, why, that was fine by us. "If none of those asshole scribblers put it in their papers, they won't," I said. "If they tried, their editors would kill it. Too gruesome for a family audience, but they won't even try. They were all vets tonight. Sometimes things go wrong, that's all. They know it as well as we do." Anderson considered a moment longer, then nodded. He turned his attention to Percy, an expression of disgust on his usually pleasant face.
"You're a little asshole," he said, "and I don't like you a bit."
He nodded at Percy's look of flabbergasted surprise. "If you tell any of your candy-ass friends I said that, I'll deny it until Aunt Rhody's old gray goose comes back to life, and these men'll back me up. You got a problem, son." He turned and started up the stairs. I let him get four steps and then said, "Curtis?" He turned back, eyebrows raised, saying nothing. "You don't want to worry too much about Percy," I said. "He's moving on to Briar Ridge soon. Bigger and better things, isn't that right, Percy?"
"As soon as his transfer comes through," Brutal added.
"And until it comes, he's going to call in sick every night," Dean put in.
That roused Percy, who hadn't been working at the prison long enough to have accumulated more than a few days' paid sick time. He looked at Dean with bright distaste.
"Don't you wish," he said,
Chapter 6. We were back on the block by 1:15 or so, except for Percy, who had been ordered to clean up the storage room and was sulking his way through the job. Me with a report to write. I decided to do it at the duty desk. If I sat in my more